Thank you, Doc. Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
We interrupt the start of this show with a special news bulletin. Hello, this is Brian Williams of NBC News. On November 22, 1963, I was a kid delivery boy in Dallas, Texas. Shortly after noon, I was making a delivery to the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, where I saw Lee Harvey Oswald kill President Kennedy. If I hadn't ducked, the bullet would have hit me. Excuse me, folks. As Flip Folsom used to say, the devil made me do it. Now, for those of you who didn't recognize the first voice, that was Frank Sinatra. He took over the Tonight Show one night, and I was the first person he booked to do a stand-up. And for those of you who don't recognize this voice, I'm John Barber, and welcome to my first show on John Barber's World, a bi-monthly show on this terrific BBS network with an absolutely amazing and first guest whose voice everyone should hear and recognize. When I was more prominent in television, hosting a number of my own shows, and especially creating and hosting Real People, America's first reality show and the number one show for the 3 years I wrote it, I was never in television so much to have my voice heard or my face seen, but to have the audience's voice heard, your voice heard. This show will be the same, as much yours as mine. I will have guests on whose views I admire, like my first guest, and guests whose views I abhor. But you would never know it from my demeanor, because the purpose of having informed guests is to extract information, not revenge. Unlike Rush and O'Reilly and O'Hannity, I do not yell at people. They think the louder they holler, the more truth they impart, when we all know a quiet truth can be like thunder. Mark Twain, my favorite writer next to Shakespeare, said it's easier to fool people than to convince them that they have been fooled. My lifelong experience in this business and in this life has convinced me that no matter how much people holler about pursuing the truth, it's not truth they're pursuing. It's confirmation for minds already made up. People do not think. They feel. They only use their minds to justify their prejudice. Because the truth is that people thought and reasoned, since all the same human knowledge is available to all of us. Knowing that and reasoning, we'd all be Democrats or Republicans or socialists or anarchists or Catholics or Protestants or Jews or Muslims or atheists. But we're not. Thankfully, we're not. Our souls have their own fingerprints. So, in lowering my voice and treating all our guests with respect, I hope to create an atmosphere where the facts can be digested by your brain and not regurgitated by your prejudices. The only times I might get loud on my show is when I set aside a few moments to do a film review, like the one about one of the most inept movies ever made, American Sniper, or comment about an offensive, unnecessary commercial like Wounded Warrior, or comment on that pasty-faced establishment hack, Brian Williams, with a couple of, like, if you tell the truth in American television, you're promptly fired. But if you lie like Brian Williams, you are permanently hired. They're just my opinions, and there'll be room for yours. But now, a man I've waited for years, and through this long introduction to talk to, Mark Twain again said, physical courage is easy. Moral courage is hard. My first guest has demonstrated both more than anyone I know. A former Marine who fought for his country in Iraq is fighting harder now for what used to be his country and our Constitution, all the way from Washington to Palestine. He is literally spending and risking his life trying to make everyone else's on the planet better. It is indeed an honor and a privilege to be talking to and listening to a one-of-a-kind Ken O'Keefe. Ken, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here.
Oh, that's a very, very kind introduction, John. Thank you very, very much, and I wish you all success with all of your guests, friend or foe, and I very much admire your approach and remember your program, actually, Real People, as a kid back in the 80s. Remember the show, actually, very well. So it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, it's more of a pleasure to speak to you, and I might say, Ken, I don't know any adult, a man or woman, my age or your age, who is where he or she expected to be in their life. Mm. If they look back to when they were 12 or 13 years of age, and you've had an adrenaline-filled, adventuresome life, but I'd like to sort of backtrack to the beginnings of it, where you were born, where you were raised, what your family was like, and what you thought of doing and being in when you were a teenager.
Well, I had a really blessed life. I was born and raised in California. I grew up in San Diego, lived in white middle-class suburbia. I used to love to play football. They call it soccer in the States, but I like to call it football. I was always around the sea. My first love was the sea. Eventually, I learned to surf and used to ditch school to go surfing, and I cared about that far more than I did about school. And I always remember as a kid, just not believing the system, the educational system was valid. I remember as an example, just, if you had, those classic tests where you have a question and what the answer is meant to be, but if you really think about the question critically, you realize that the correct answer is not the one that you'll be marked correct for. And, I was one of those kids that might point out that type of thing. And I remember, the reaction of the teachers was, stop causing problems, this sort of thing.
How old were you? Were you in public school or high school?
Yeah, regular public school. And I mean, I remember this kind of stuff as early as certainly, seventh, eighth grade, something like that. It was around that time. And I just look back at that and I think to myself, actually, if the system was correct, that is exactly the kind of student that the teacher would say, now everybody, I want you to pay attention to the student so-and-so. That is an excellent job of critical thinking and pointing that out. And that's the type of thing that we should foster in school. But of course, it's not. It's all about indoctrination. And part of the reason why I've been able to kind of see the world in a more accurate way, at least from my perspective, is that I wasn't so overwhelmed by that rubbish. It didn't sink into me. I was raised by a single mom, and if my dad had raised me, probably I would have been forced to get A's, and maybe it would have sunk in deeper and I never would have recovered. But the indoctrination process.
What happened to your father?
Well, my mom and dad got divorced when I was 5 years old, and he was around, but he wasn't really a very... he wasn't the best father that you could hope for. He wasn't a bad man. I love him. He's since passed. But actually, that's why I joined the Marine Corps. I didn't know at the time, but I the lack of a father and discipline and initiative were the reasons why I joined the Marine Corps. But I look back at it now and I realize actually I was seeking the father that I didn't really have.
It's absolutely astonishing. I mean, we don't even know each other, even though I know a lot about you because I read everything, and every time you're on television, I make it a point to watch. But it's astonishing how similar our backgrounds were. My father left. I was born and raised in Canada. I was born in the Salvation Army Hospital, Charity Hospital in Toronto when I was six. My father, I came from a severely dysfunctional family before it was popular.
Yeah.
1939, my father joined the Canadian Army to get away to the peace and quiet of World War II. I was 16, I tried to join the Canadian Air Force in Buffalo so that I could get to the United States. I'd spent all my life in a movie theater because I was afraid to go home. So it said made in Hollywood at the end of the movie. So I got the highest grades when I was tested. And the instructor made the mistake of saying that this kid from Canada got the highest grades we've ever had in these tests. He asked us to stay overnight for a physical the next day, and we stayed on the 13th floor, and I was awakened at 2 o'clock in the morning by four guys trying to throw me out a window. So in any event, it's just astonishing how similar that is. Did you have brothers or sisters?
No, only child as well. So,
and okay, you said you joined the Marines. How old were you when you joined the Marines?
Yeah, I was 19 years old, and you know, like every other American, I firmly believed that my nation was the greatest in the world. You know, that level of indoctrination had certainly sunk in, and there are many great things about America, of course. You know, it's certainly not all bad, but I was in an indoctrinated state. I thought I was a fairly clever young man, and you know, I look back at my views back then and I realize how completely silly they were, but they were very real at the time. Was there
some kind of conflict or war going on when you joined?
No, not when I joined. I joined in 89, but of course the first Gulf War kicked off in 90, and then the ground war kicked off in 91. You know, I was ready and raring to go. You know,
did you volunteer to go to Desert Storm, or were you part of the troop that was sent over?
I actually did. My unit ended up going anyway, but I actually did volunteer before my unit had been assigned to go. So I was ready to go. I was definitely ready to go. And again, just things happened in my life that really turned it into a totally different direction. And you know, in the short version of that story is basically that, you know, I stood up and I did the right thing while I was in the Marine Corps. I was a good Marine. You know, I take pride in what I do, and I did it well. And I spoke out because my superiors were basically violating their position of power. They were not leading by example, and this is one of the tenets of the Marine Corps. And I firmly believe in it.
What were you speaking out about? I mean, what was it that they were doing that you brought to their attention?
The crux of it was we were on a ship. It was very, very hot. And we were in the Mediterranean, and the staff NCOs, these are Marines who've been in for, you know, at least 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. These are hardened enlisted Marines. And basically what they did was they told all of the lower ranking troops that we were no longer allowed to go through their berthing area on the ship. And what this meant was we were having to go, you know, three times as far to get to many of the common areas that we go. This was creating a safety issue because we were going into working areas for the Navy personnel. They were violating the rules as well because they have no authority to close off a passageway. Only the captain and the chief of the chief naval officer of the ship can do that. And the reason why they were doing it was because they wanted to keep their berthing area, what little air conditioning, they wanted to keep it in there. They didn't want the hatch opened. So it would make it hotter. So the bottom line was they were effectively using their position of power and rank to make life more difficult, which is no problem. Let's make a distinction here. A lot of the training, this is the Marine Corps infantry, a lot of the training is making your life difficult to put you through adversity. And I have no problem with that. But this was not about that. This was about them being more comfortable and having more air conditioning and creating safety hazards for ourselves and the Navy personnel. And it was a total violation of leadership by example. Is that what we're meant to do? So we get rank, and then we just, like, we want to be more comfortable and screw everybody else? I mean, come on. That's not leadership.
You know, Ken, it's like you're repeating your attitude towards your teachers when you realize that the questions were faulty questions, that your first confrontation in the Marines was not so much about U.S. foreign policy as it was about your superiors.
This was the vehicle for me. You know, this was the vehicle, and you know what ended up happening was, you know, and I did the honorable thing again. You watch the Marine Corps commercials, you know, honor and integrity. You know, I made an active decision that I would own up to this. I would not do it clandestinely. I could have done it quietly, and no one would have known, but I didn't do that. I owned up to it, and the moment that I rose my hand and said, "Yes, I'm the one who did that," everything changed for me. Everything. And I was looking over my shoulder constantly, you know, the classic, you know, if you've seen Full Metal Jacket, you know, Private Pyle is the problem Marine. Eventually, the drill instructor stops punishing Private Pyle and punishes the whole platoon. But they all know they're being punished because of Private Pyle. The same tactic was done with me. And so I had a, you know, a platoon of Marines who hated me. And I only had really a couple of friends. And it made my life extremely difficult. But this was the best thing that ever happened to me, because the trauma of standing up and doing the right thing, the right and honorable thing, and then being punished was my wake-up call to the world and the way the world really functions. I thought you were supposed to be rewarded for standing up and doing the right thing. You know, and when I realized that that wasn't the case, and in fact, I had a man who was in charge of me, who eventually I went to a war, you know, with, who vowed to, you know, fry my ass, to quote him, who hated me. You know, this was a trauma, and that trauma was what allowed me to begin to understand the way the world really functions. And when I got out of the Marine Corps, I started to study from independent sources of politics and history, and I realized, holy crap. Just about everything I've been told is a lie. You know, just about everything.
What do you know? I'm reminded of an interview I had with Jim Garrison, who was very conservative and independent. He was a lieutenant colonel. He had a former FBI agent, and I asked him, "Why on earth do you, you know, whatever made you think you could take on the federal government?" When he opened up his case, and he said, "John, I guess as a kid, I saw one too many Frank Capra movies." Yeah. Well, that's what you sound like. So what? Now, you questioned your superiors. Were you drummed out of the Marines, or did you get out of the Marines?
Well, what happened was, you know, I'll always remember his words. I changed my name later to O'Keefe for no nefarious reasons. It's my family name and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I'll always remember his words. You know, once they found out it was me, I was taken to a back corner of the ship. And he said to me, "Nichols, in my 17 years in the Marine Corps, you're the biggest piece of shit I've ever known, and I'm going to fry your ass first chance I get." Jesus. And he wasn't joking. I mean, you know, when your platoon sergeant, 17-year Marine, says he hates you and is going to fry your ass, trust me, your life is going to get difficult. And, you know, it wasn't more than a month and a half I was facing totally ridiculous dereliction of duty charges for having surface rust on my weapon. You know, I took a lot of pride in the way I maintained my weapon. There was nothing out of the norm. In fact, the condition of my weapon was better than most.
Then what was it that first made you question not the Marine Corps or their superiors, but to question the foreign policy of the United States and being in a place like Iraq in the first place? What was your first wake up, real wake up?
It didn't really happen until after the Marine Corps, you know, and that's when I started studying. I read books like Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, classic, classic book. A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, another great book.
The best history book ever written about America.
Yeah, you could study history for decades and not know a damn thing. You could read that one book and know more about American history than you'll learn from Harvard. So, I mean, you know, it's I've been very, very fortunate in that the type of things that I've read have been high quality. Very rarely did I waste my time with books that were full of crap.
When you began to speak up about, do you remember the first time you really spoke out publicly against U.S. foreign policy? And what kind of reaction did you get, and where were you when it happened? And what did your mother think of what was happening to you?
Yeah, well, you know, I remember very vividly, it was in the mid-90s, that I was taking a course called American History from a Black Perspective, and this was at San Diego City College. And I remember during that course that I decided eventually I was going to renounce my U.S. citizenship, because one of the things that affected me so badly with that course was that when I was a kid, we were bused once a week to the poor Black neighborhood, you know, for integration. And I was always kind of a rambunctious kid, so I got into, you know, I got into fights more than most kids did. You know, I never really accepted people trying to, you know, beat me down or intimidate me. If someone did that, then I would get into a fight with them. So this busing me to the Black neighborhood, the poor Black neighborhood, led me to circumstances where I would get into a fight with one Black kid, or I would, you know, get into a problem with one Black kid. And before you know it, I'm fighting three or four Black kids. And I started to develop a real strong prejudice towards Blacks. I was never a racist, out and out racist. I mean, I had Black friends, but I was developing strong prejudices and even flirted with some of the white supremacist groups that were around at that time. And only after I had gotten out of the Marine Corps, and started to study. And in particular, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X. And when I realized what it is to be black in America, to this day, I realized that if I had been born black in America, that I'd be one dangerous son of a bitch, probably in prison. And, you know, I would not be handling Whitey looking at me as a nigger, you know, and that's the bottom line. That still exists to this day. And I'm sure I would not handle it well at all. So, you know, when I realized just how bad it was, that was the point where I decided I would renounce my U.S. citizenship. And I did that in March of 2001. And that is a very detailed process. And I wrote down a many-page manifesto or, you know, declaration of why I was renouncing. So I basically told the State Department directly to their face why I was absolutely ashamed of what they did and how I could never be party to a contract in which you are compelling me to pay for the murder of my brothers and sisters halfway around the world, almost always based on a pack of lies. Never mind, you know, the genocide against Native Americans, enslavement of black people that we've never really even so much as apologized for. You know, we can go on and on and on.
Where were you going to go, and what was your mother's reaction to what you were doing? Was she still alive?
Yeah. My mom just actually passed on almost exactly a year ago. And she was a very special mother. I mean, like too many mothers, I suppose, she spoiled her only son. You know, I was definitely a bit of a spoiled brat, but she gave me a lot of love and also instilled in me morals and values, despite the fact that I was a rambunctious kid and did all sorts of nonsense. But you know, she knew from a young age, you know, how I was. And I did, you know, really kind of crazy stuff throughout. And by the time I reached my late 20s and early 30s and renounced, I'd also marked myself up with a lot of tattoos for various reasons. She was kind of used to it, but I guess you never really get completely used to it. But she was the kind of mother that loved me unconditionally. And if it was what I needed to do, then she was behind me. She would also...
When you began to speak up really publicly and gain a national and international voice about America's foreign policy, were you ever concerned that something might happen to you the way it happened to Pat Tillman when he decided that, you know, this thing in Afghanistan is a crock, as is all foreign policy, and he was in touch with Noam Chomsky when he was killed. Were you ever concerned about that?
Well, I really look at Malcolm X. When he was asked, you know, what is the price for freedom, his response to that was, the price for freedom is death. And if you're not willing to pay that price, then don't use that word in your vocabulary. The world that we live in does not allow for people of honor and integrity. You know, my ultimate reward in this world, as long as it remains this way, is to be taken out. Because eventually, if you become that much of a threat, that's what they will do. And they will find a way to do it, one way or the other. And until we change this world, it will remain that way. And many, many, many beautiful people have already been taken out because this is the policy. So, you know, my ultimate goal is a better world. You know, that is what I want. I want a better world. I want everyone to be able to be who they are. I want a world in which a healthy environment is fostered for everyone so that all of these amazing talents that we have as people, all these amazing capabilities, philosophically, artistically, you name it, intellectually, all these things are really being thwarted on so many different levels. It's not even funny. I want to see a world.
On the internet, Ken, there is probably no one, quite honestly, who is articulate and is compassionate and is truthful about the world and America's foreign policy and who shapes it and the dangers that you face when you try to correct these faults. I have almost every one of Noam Chomsky's books about U.S. foreign policy, and he attacks it vigorously and intellectually and truthfully. And I think I saw a picture of you with Noam Chomsky, but I have a blind spot with him. And the blind spot is the way he sort of condescendingly just fluffs off people who question him about the John Kennedy assassination or 9/11. It just that he doesn't seem to be any longer an intellectual. Are there such a thing, as many people say, left-wing gatekeepers in this country, and would Noam Chomsky be one, and have you ever had conversations with them?
I have, actually. I am still on certain levels a deep admirer of Noam. He was a big, big part of my awakening. I read so many different books and articles from him regarding American foreign policy, and he helped me develop my understanding. But I agree with you 100%. He is a very intelligent man. The official version of 9/11 is an insult to any thinking person. So at the very least, he would have to say, you know, the official version is complete hogwash. But he doesn't do that. And as you say, he marginalizes people and condescends to them when they question him or the official version. Same with Kennedy. I'm a firm believer. I've actually only in the last few years become really proud of John F. Kennedy. And I'm really happy to know that there has been at least one president who actually had real honor and integrity. And of course, he was taken right out. But, you know, he was a good man. I mean, most of his career, he was just a servant to the rich like everybody else. But I believe the Cuban Missile Crisis transformed him. And he clearly disobeyed orders at the period after the Cuban Missile Crisis. So Noam Chomsky is definitely a gatekeeper with regard to 9/11 and also Kennedy. He's a very intelligent man. I don't know if it's fear, maybe because he has a huge audience. Maybe he's been gotten to, and you know, they say if you talk about this, you're done. I don't know. Or maybe he's a gatekeeper. Maybe his whole purpose is to keep us away from these things, to marginalize those who question it. Either way, my approach to him and a lot of other people is that I love him for the beautiful information that he's put out there. I'm grateful for that, and I believe this is one of the great tasks for human beings as a whole, and that is to be critically thinking in our ability and to be able to see the good, take the good, accept the good, be grateful for it, and see the rubbish and just leave it off to the side. Don't worry about it. Let us not look to some single source to be a perfect source for all information. Noam Chomsky is a great source of information for a lot of different subjects. Let us not consider him an enemy when there are still many great things coming from him. But if we want to know about 9/11 and John F. Kennedy, this is not the man to look to.
What was the most dangerous time in your life? Was it when you tried to bring relief and supplies to Gaza during Israel's bombardment of them?
Well, I'd have to say there was a period when I did the Human Shield action to Iraq where it was all completely infiltrated and subverted, and you know, I had people even saying that I was CIA in Baghdad with Saddam Hussein there, and that was quite dangerous and very stressful to say the least. But probably the most dangerous thing was on the Mavi Marmara in 2010 when the Israelis came aboard. I was involved in disarming a couple of commandos, and I actually had one of their 9mm pistols for a good probably 10 minutes or so. And I look back at it now and I realize how nuts it was that I was carrying that weapon around the ship. I mean, I was begging to be killed. I was trying to figure out what to do with it. It was evidence, quite frankly, and I did not feel good about throwing evidence into the sea. It could have been a weapon that was used to execute one of the 9 people that were killed at that time. You know, a 10th person died later. So I was trying to figure out what to do with the weapon, but this was extremely dangerous. I suppose either I've got guardian angels or, you know, God looking after me, or they had direct orders not to kill white people, which is definitely a distinct possibility. But that was extremely dangerous.
How do you earn a living, Ken?
Well, I'm now producing work for Press TV. I'm making some money from that. I also produce stuff independently and just put it on YouTube. And I do, you know, a little bit of work here and there. I mean, I do some carpentry stuff, and I do a little bit of you know, blue collar work every now and then as well. But a lot of the way that I've been able to do what I've done over the last, in particular, decade and a half, because I did have a business until I fled the United States in 2001, 2 months after 9/11, which was no coincidence. I fled the United States. I left my business in Hawaii. You know, I had a life most people would kill for. I lived on the beach. I had money, a scuba diving, whale watching business, my own boat, my own dive shop, my own dive facility, everything, you know. But I left it. I knew I had to go. And from that point in 2001, all the way up, really up until only a few years ago, I lived off of the goodwill of a lot of people, you know, who helped me out and allowed me to get this stuff off my chest, because quite frankly, I needed to get it off my chest.
Are you married, Ken?
I am, yeah, I am, and I have a couple of kids, two boys. And
how old are your boys, and what are their names?
Well, they're 3 and 6.
And, terrific. Yeah. And how long have you been married?
Well, we've known each other for 11 years, and we've been married basically 7 years.
Is she concerned and fearful about the stance that you take? And not just in America, but you take this stance. I mean, the most thrilling times I've seen you on television was when you were on the BBC and you were debating somebody from the U.S. State Department and just absolutely buried them. I mean, there was no way that they could confront the facts that you were burying him with. Is your wife concerned or fearful?
Well, I'm very fortunate in that, you know, we both have a very strong sort of spiritual awareness, and you know, you can be as cautious as you want to be, and you know, you could fall in the shower and bang your head and be dead tomorrow. I mean, you know, or you can take risks. You know, from my perspective, if you're going to take risks, let them be worthwhile. You know, don't take stupid risks where, you know, you're toying with your life and for what? So if you're going to do something that potentially puts your life at risk, then make it worth it. And so, you know, she knows that what I'm doing is worth it. And she also knows that it's for our kids. It's for, you know, your kids. It's for everyone else's kids. They don't have a future as it stands right now. So whether I die, you know, tomorrow or, you know, 10 years from now or whatever, hardly matters if we don't change this world, because, you know, you and I both know there is no future with the way the world is going right now. In fact, these bastards who are running the world are doing everything they can to instigate a third world war. And that's just blatantly obvious if we look at what these son of a bitches are doing. So it hardly matters what happens to me. And I think, you know, my wife has a pretty good grasp of that.
Do you believe, as many critics of U.S. foreign policy do, even Noam Chomsky refers to it frequently, that U.S. foreign policy is created, engineered, and implemented by Israel?
Yeah, it's
APAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee.
This is, you know, for me, this is the main message that I will keep drumming to my American brothers and sisters. You know, the founding fathers of America warned us about the enemy inside the gates. The enemy is well inside the gate. The U.S. Congress, as we see, Netanyahu, a horrendous piece of work, a war criminal par excellence, has been invited back to the U.S. Congress for a record third time. The only other head of state who's been invited to the U.S. to speak at the U.S. Congress three times is Winston Churchill. So we're putting, I don't like Winston Churchill at all, but most people would see him as one of the great figures of the 20th century. And here we have Netanyahu being invited, a war criminal and much worse. And this man will come, and the last time he came in 2011, the U.S. Congress, these sycophants, these disgraceful pack of thieves and traitors, gave him 29 standing ovations. It is an embarrassment, and I don't know how
quickly an insert about this. I understand. Quickly an insert about this, Ken, is that this third invitation was extended by John Boehner, violating American government protocol. He extended the invitation, and not the president or the secretary of state. How can he get away with that?
Well, it's just so disgusting. I mean, it's quite clear that the boss, Netanyahu, let me just get this straight. Netanyahu is a puppet. I do believe he's a high-level puppet. You know, he does probably have some involvement with strategy or tactics, but, you know, the main players are never in the public eye. If you want to ask me who runs the world, then I will say for sure it's those who control the money supply. So we're not allowed to even know who the private shareholders of the private bank of the Federal Reserve are, or the Bank of England, or the European Central Bank, or the other major banks, the Bank of International Settlements, World Bank, the IMF, and so on. Those who control the money supply run the world, and they've bought everything and everyone that can be bought. So the people of honor and integrity who cannot be bought, they don't get these jobs. But the the pedophiles and the sexual deviants and the total prostitutes, those are the ones that get these jobs. So Netanyahu is like the favorite little plaything. Israel is their favorite little plaything, and he's the head of that state. So he doesn't tell. He's not making the decisions, but he's a direct conduit to the powers that be. And who is the president of the United States? He's he's an errand boy. He's say? He's an Uncle Tom, quite frankly.
Barack Obama's a lawn jockey for Goldman Sachs. But I remember when I was interviewing Jim Garrison, he pointed out to me that every publicly traded company in this country, you can investigate them and find out who the shareholders were, except during the Vietnam War, the six major weapons companies, the Bell Helicopter and all the others, you can never find out who the stockholders were during the Vietnam War, because Garrison tried to find out and was unable to, and he was a district attorney.
Wow. I did not know that.
Oh. Yeah. So Doug tells me we have a call. I want to continue talking to you. But Doug, if you could put the caller through, because I wouldn't like to keep him waiting. Oh, that's okay. We lost the caller. I'm sorry. Next time, Doug, I'll take the call immediately. It's just that Ken is so interesting. Ken, what do you do for recreation?
Well, you know what? For the first time in probably over 20 years, I went and played tennis tonight. so that was it was quite nice. I'm here in England. I actually live in Wimbledon. So why not? We've joined a club, and I think I'm going to play some tennis. I'd love to be by the sea. I'd prefer to be in Hawaii, quite frankly, and going out into the sea and diving and so on. But this'll do.
Kenny, we're going to take a break right now. And when we come back, I have a couple of questions I wish to ask you, but I'll save those till after the break. Hang on just a second. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face. Oh, sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber, you remember him, he's been my guest on this program a couple of times. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience a couple of weeks ago, actually a couple of months now. They had a screening of Barber's terrific and I'd say historic film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. Terrific stuff. It's now out on a DVD, and Lex put a link on our Twitter feed, our Coast Twitter feed. You can find it on the website, along with a lot of other good stuff. So take a peek when you get a minute. We're going to take our first break, and when we come back, the mysterious aircraft of Area 51, Bill Yenny and the Black Jets. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
Terrific unsolicited review of our documentary, The Last Word on the Assassination. You can get it at Amazon as well as read dozens of other terrific unsolicited reviews, some from some from very famous people. And while you're there, for just a couple of bucks, you might want to pick up John Barber's Uncensored Facebook book, Volume 1, with the terrific intro by Richard Belzer. You can open it any place and find something that'll make you laugh or think. It's sort of chicken soup for the funny bone. I wish to ask you, but you know, in the 70s, the Church Committee revealed that the CIA had over 1,000 assets working in American media. Now, that's when they were fighting the pseudo-real war in Vietnam, where you could see the enemy, and the enemy was yellow. But now we're fighting ghosts, as Gore Vidal said. He said it's like fighting the war on dandruff. It's an ever-ending war, as George Orwell predicted in 1984. They don't want an end to a war. They want to continue war. But during the 70s, the CIA was sort of depicted as the bad guys. And I remember Norman Mailer and a lot of his wealthy, chic liberal friends in New York created a wonderful magazine called Counterspy, in which they revealed a lot of the skullduggery of what the CIA was up to. And then evidently a CIA asset in Athens was murdered by left-wingers, and all of that sort of shut down. But Norman had an enormous amount of help and monetary help from the wealthy and the famous. Are you ever approached, even sort of surreptitiously, by somebody wealthy or somebody famous who says, geez, Ken, I admire you so much and you're so right. Here's 10,000 or 20,000 or 40,000 to help your cause. Does that happen to you?
No, that's not happened. I've had with some of the things that I've initiated, Trade Not Aid for Palestine and also the Human Shield Action for Iraq, I did have very wealthy people contact me, and I've met with some of them. I actually met with the richest man in Palestine, a billionaire, about one of my projects, and I've come, you know, somewhat close to sealing the deal. But when it comes down to it, it doesn't happen, and I'm convinced the reason why it doesn't happen is that, you know, if I do have a large sum of money, I mean, you know, a significant sum of money, I will do a lot with it for sure. You know, I will use that money very effectively to go after the weak points of the power structure, and you know, this is what I've done. But the people who have that kind of real money, serious money, they realize this, and that's why I think I don't get it. Because if you do help me, if you do give me a significant sum of money, and you've got a bunch of money yourself, you can. I mean, I'll have to be honest. I mean, you better expect major problems.
Well, it would seem to me that, for example, somebody like a Michael Moore, who's become a mega millionaire making some interesting documentaries, might approach somebody like you and try to follow you and do your life story, because the contributions that you make are just absolutely astonishing.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned Michael Moore, because I was in Iraq in 2004, and he had a producer there who was doing some groundwork for him for a film. And he interviewed me, and we actually went into the green zone together, and I actually did some interviews with some soldiers and was asking them questions about depleted uranium and their awareness and da-da-da-da-da. And this was really classic footage, really good stuff, and it was buried. I lost track. The guy disappeared, and nothing ever happened with it. So I would say even Michael Moore wouldn't touch me, you know, for sure he wouldn't touch me.
Doug, did you say we had a caller? Could you put him or her on, please?
Hello.
Hi, this is John, and you're speaking.
Hello.
Ian Ken, how are you?
Hello, John and Ken. This is Mike in California, actually the producer, and the show is streaming worldwide. We have a question from a listener in Iran.
This oh, my is Rox- goodness.
This is Rox in Iran, and she asks, is Ken O'Keefe aware of Iran's human rights violations, since he works for them, and is he aware of Israel's secret relationship with the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, first off, I don't work for Press TV. I actually do my own production, and Press TV use it. They do pay me for it, but I'm not under their direction. I make work completely independently. So let's be clear about that. As far as human rights violations, yes, there are human rights violations in Iran, and there are human rights violations in every country of the world. Am I trying to marginalize what happens in Iran? No. But I don't see human rights problems in Iran as being the major threat to the world. And I'm certainly not going to be distracted from the most pressing issues of the day by human rights abuses in Iran or Saudi Arabia or Nicaragua or, you know, America. I mean, the bottom line is I'm against human rights violations across the board. With regard to Iran's apparently, you know, from this person's perspective, secret relationship with Israel, you know what? I've heard that. I don't see evidence for it. You know, if it's true, it's done very, very well. I can agree that potentially it is the whole world is a stage, so it's possible that Iran is completely controlled and somehow playing the bad cop and America's the good cop or vice versa, depending on how you want to say it. But I don't see the evidence for that. I hear a lot of people saying that, especially former or Iranian citizens, disgruntled Americans, kind of like the Cubans who left Cuba. They're very, very hateful towards Cuba and Castro. I've talked to many Iranians who feel the same way, but I don't see the evidence for it.
Ken, if a relationship like that existed, why would Netanyahu, this week he said that Israel would do everything to destroy this upcoming signing of a pact? I think it's called P5. It's a pact between the United States, United Kingdom, Russia, and China, I believe, and three European countries to help break down the blockade that we've implemented against Iran. And Netanyahu says he's going to do everything to destroy that.
Yeah, there's so many things about Iran that are blatantly untrue. One of them is that, you know, we continually hear about Iran trying to develop a nuclear weapon. Actually, Iran's been the most inspected country in the world. There is no evidence to support it. In fact, even heads of Mossad and the CIA have said that there is no evidence that they're trying to develop nuclear weapons. And actually, if you listen to the supreme leader, both the current one and the previous one, which was Imam or Ayatollah Khomeini, the much hated leader of the Iranian Revolution of 1979, they have made it very clear that nuclear weapons are in fact an affront to God. And this is, when you think about it, imagine that. When I hear about Christians, people call themselves Christians, the thing that I want to ask them is, I want you to tell me, what country would Jesus bomb? Because as far as I understand Jesus Christ, he's not really the kind of person that would seem to endorse bombing people. And this is, you know, what Christianity is today. Yet I see in Iran, ironically, people who call themselves Muslims, and the supreme leader is, you know, the supreme leader for a reason. He is somebody who is supposed to exemplify the values of Islam, not this ISIS, you know, branded, you know, smear campaign against Islam, but real Islam. And what he has said, and his predecessor has said, is that the nuclear weapons are haram. That it makes sense, doesn't it? If God created all that is, surely God didn't create all that is just so that we could be so arrogant to develop a technology to destroy all that is. I mean, it makes no sense. And what does God favor America? Oh, it's okay for America to have them, but it's not okay for that. I mean, come on. This is ridiculous. Totally ridiculous. So I actually believe that Iran is not pursuing nuclear weapons, because not only do they say it, but they're consistent with that. They haven't invaded or attacked another country for over 300 years, despite the fact that they've been attacked repeatedly and lost much territory. And in fact, we sicked our attack dog, Saddam Hussein, on them, who used chemical weapons and attacked over 100,000 Iranians with chemical weapons, and they did not respond in kind. So
those chemical weapons, by the way, were supplied by the United States, and there's a famous picture on the internet of the Defense Department. He was in there shaking hands with Saddam Hussein.
Rumsfeld?
Yeah, Donald Rumsfeld.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it was Rumsfeld on September 10th, who went on national television and said there's $2 or 3 trillion missing from the Pentagon, and we've started an investigation. And the investigation ended the following day with the collapse of the Twin Towers in Building 7, which was not hit by anything but smoke.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's beggar's belief, really, quite frankly. Going back to the question of the person supposedly from Iran, one of my policies, quite frankly, is that I'm sick and tired of Western people pointing the finger elsewhere. It's not to say that there aren't problems elsewhere. There are. But our house in the West, in America, in Britain, and throughout the West, our house is a dirty, filthy mess of corruption. And how dare we sit here and point the finger at other nations, especially when the hypocrisy is so insane that we have no problem with Saudi Arabia, which is cutting off people's heads and hands. Women aren't allowed to drive a car or walk around on their own. We have no problem with that. One defense contract with Saudi Arabia between the United States and Saudi Arabia was $60 billion. So when Western people start pointing a finger at certain nations and saying, oh, look at their human rights issues, I find it disingenuous at best. But the Iranian people, I would encourage them to improve your country. Do what you need to do to improve it. And if you feel that it's unacceptable the way it is, then, well, do what you got to do to improve it. That's what we need to do in the West, because our house is a dirty, filthy mess, and we have no right to point a finger at someone else's mess.
But that has been our policy for more than 60 years. I mean, Mark Twain pointed it out very early. And then, of course, the revelations that Allende was murdered by the CIA, and Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, he wanted to nationalize AT&T and Coca-Cola. All this was revealed in congressional hearings. And there were some intellectuals who claim that Henry Kissinger is a war criminal, but these same intellectuals, one of them who used to do a column for Vanity Fair and died a couple of years ago, a very bright guy, he can look at Henry Kissinger and call him a war criminal when it is so obvious that George Bush is much more of a war criminal than Henry Kissinger, and yet defends his actions in Iraq. How can intellectuals come to those conclusions? And that's why I say, Ken, I do not think people think. And this was a case where an intellectual did not think.
Well, indoctrination is an incredibly powerful thing. And I the story I told you earlier about the trauma that I went through, you know, trauma is not always a bad thing. You know, sometimes you need to be jarred in order to readjust your outlook. And oftentimes trauma, especially when it brings you close to death, can make you reevaluate yourself, you know, the value of life, and to make the most of it. So, you know, for me, it was a blessing, but indoctrination is very, very powerful. A lot of people never break free from it, and they think they're thinking. I thought I was a thinking person too, you know. I really did. I thought I was a pretty clever, pretty bright 18, 19-year-old, and I look back at it now and I realize I was only regurgitating the bogus information that I was being handed. That's all I was doing, just regurgitation. That's all it was.
Do you think, Ken, that there was some foreknowledge on the part of the American government of 911?
There's simply no question of that. No question of that. You have players within the U.S. government, especially many dual nationals, Michael Chertoff and people like this. There is no way that operation could have been carried out without the knowledge of Americans. But clearly, Mossad's fingerprints are all over it. You have people like Larry Silverstein and Frank Lowy, two Jewish billionaires who bought a worthless building, a financial liability that was full of asbestos. They proceeded to double the insurance policy and then made out like bandits after the building came down 6 weeks after they purchased the lease. So, you know, these people are not stupid. And they bought buildings that were, you know, completely and totally a liability. There's no reason why they would have bought those unless they had foreknowledge of what was going to happen. And there are a lot of other people like that as well. There's, to me, it is beyond ridiculous that we even entertained in the first place the 19 hijackers and Osama bin Laden. You know, the fact that people did believe that is confirmation of what you're saying, John. People are not thinking. You know, that was a fairy story from the beginning.
The most astonishing thing, though, was that there wasn't one Iraqi passport or name discovered, and yet somehow or other the government was able to convince this country over people literally by the millions around America and the world protesting what they were going to do in Iraq, and they still went into Iraq with shock and awe, which is not a war. It's target practice. It's like a video game to those people.
Yeah, and you know, this is where people, if they really want to know what happened, then you really need to read A Clean Break by the Project for a New American Century. And also, I would highly recommend Oded Yanan's A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s, because both of these documents lay out very clearly that target number one for Israel was Iraq. And this is all part of the Greater Israel Project, Israel's expansion into Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. This is part of their fantasy goal. And this is why we invaded Iraq. These American sons and daughters were sacrificed for this agenda. And this is a very hard truth that we will have to face,
Ken,
at some point.
Where can people go to listen to you and to look at you?
Well, I have a YouTube channel. I mean, if you put in Ken O'Keefe, you know, you can easily find the channel that way. I do plan to put out some more videos. And, you know, I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, so people can find me there rather easily as well. But, you know, I'm a fairly regular guest on Press TV and also Russia Today and sometimes other programs as well.
I've been really, really honored to have you as a guest, Ken. I admire you so much, and I don't usually like to take sides with any guests, but you're an enlightening joy. And if you give my producer your address in England or Hawaii or Ireland or Palestine or wherever you happen to be, I would love to send you a copy of The Last Word on the Assassination, because as much as you may think you know, or anybody may think they know about that assassination, until you look at and listen to Jim Garrison's case and what he uncovers, you're going to be astonished, absolutely wow. Astonished. So I would love to send it to you as a gift.
Well, thank you very, very much, my brother. That's very kind. It's been a real pleasure. I wish you really all success, and I do have many reasons to be optimistic. I hope people share in that optimism, and we make a better world. I want America to turn it around as well, and we can.
Well, thank you so much. In 2 weeks, you're going to hear an unbelievable lady, one of the most terrific ladies on the planet, who's also trying to save the planet, Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Yeah.
As Ed Murrow used to say before they took him off the air for telling the truth, good luck and good night.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.